Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom, Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I'm the editor of the TLS, and I am, of course, with Thea Leneduzzi, Italian chatelaine that she is. Thea, we've not had an Alf update for a while. How's he coped with the heat?
He's been quite still. Oh. He's been very, very hot. He's got a double coat, you see.
Oh no.
Yeah.
You like the heat. You like the heat though, don't you?
I love the heat, so yeah, I'm fine with it. Have I told you that he's basically, as if overnight, become a teenager? Have I told you that?
Go on.
So he's approaching his first birthday, we think, you know, insofar as we can know that from a dog who was found on the street.
Yeah.
And yeah, he's become very emotional.
God's sake.
He's very amorous 1 minute.
Is
and
he?
Then, yeah. And then beside himself with fear and worry
Ooh
the next.
Oh, my God.
He's all over the place. He's a wreck.
He's like, you're now living with a hairy teenager.
He's very emo.
No one wants a hairy emo. Well, you do, don't you?
I love him.
You love the hairy emo dog. Alf, the hairy emo dog, is perhaps how it will now remain in my mind. Well, enough of that. Here's the bit where I plug subscriptions to the TLS and give you a special offer available only to our podcast listeners. If you live in the USA or Canada, go to podcast.the-tls.com. If you live anywhere else, including the UK, go to the-tls.co.uk/pod19 and you'll get 5 issues for just £5 or $5. This week, our favourite campaigner for justice, Clive Stafford Smith, is on the line from Islamabad. He has written a pretty savage review of a book by an American prosecutor and offers his own experience of American justice. Sarah Green is in the studio to tell the story not only of the poet Lionel Johnson, a figure from the 1890s, but also the failed attempts to tell his story ever since, including by a criminal in the 1950s who once stole bedding from an aristocrat. And David Hurd has been telling his refugee tales for the last 5 years, an annual event that is part walking pilgrimage, part protest, and part collection of narratives about those unjustly treated by Britain's questionable immigration system. He will bear witness once more with us. In the 1950s, Adrian Earle was convicted of stealing miscellaneous items from Lady Beaumont, including a guitar, a necklace, a recording machine, and a quantity of dresses and bedding, and demanding money with menaces from her fiancé. What, you might say, has that got to do with the poet and critic from the 1890s, Lionel Johnson? Well, as Sarah Green tells us, Earle also spent his time collecting biographical material about Johnson and not sharing it with anyone. He's one of the reasons so many Johnson biographies have failed to be written. So what can we now know about Lionel Johnson, and how central a figure to the turn of the century literary world is he? Sarah Green has made a fascinating biographical study of her own and is in the studio to tell us more. Sarah, hello.
Hi.
Let's deal with poor old Adrian Earle before we get to Johnson. What was his game? Why was he so interested in grabbing stuff about Johnson, and how much damage has he done, do you think?
Well, I mean, it's hard to know what his motivation could have been if it wasn't just that he was very interested in Lionel Johnson. He had certain similarities himself. They'd both been to Winchester College, for example, which might have been where he got that from. Adrian Earle was also very close with Alfred Douglas, who had been a very good friend of Lionel Johnson's.
Bosie.
Douglas, yeah, and obviously he's much older by this point. But,
yeah. Oscar Wilde's lover, I'm sure everyone knows.
Yes, yeah.
But he wasn't a... He's not a writer, though, Alfred Earle. You don't think he was collecting this stuff to write a biography himself?
Well, he wrote a little bit. He always claimed to be writing a biography. It never materialised, but so did many failed biographies of Lionel Johnson never materialise. I think he probably was quite seriously thinking of doing something and was holding on to the material because that's what you did then.
Well, he was collecting for some 10 years, I think you say.
Yeah, quite a long time. And never really sold anything, which I think is the interesting thing, because I think there were points when he was really short on money.
So where is the stuff?
God knows.
So we don't know.
I wish I knew.
We don't know what he's got.
We don't know what he has.
And we don't know what he did with it.
We don't know what he did with it.
That's extraordinary. Well, before I read this piece, actually, Lionel Johnson didn't mean very much to me as a name. What do we know about, if someone said give the elevator pitch for Lionel Johnson that's known generally, what would it be?
So there are certain sort of key things that they might know. He's an 1890s poet. They're less likely to know that he's a literary critic as well. They probably know that he was an alcoholic. He died prematurely in 1902 by a massive stroke. He was only 35 years old. Was good friends with Walter Pater and a lot of the other literary figures of the 1890s.
So he's kind of this figure of the 1890s.
Yeah.
And he wrote a poem which is called Dark Angel?
Dark Angel, yeah. That's the most anthologised, most widely known.
So here's this figure. We know a bit about him. It's a pretty exciting time in terms of people like sort of Oscar Wilde time, Walter Pater.
Yeah,
people love this.
Yeah.
Hardy's around, Yeats is about. This is quite a good Inglit time, isn't it,
for
people. So what did you discover, Sarah?
So I was on a trip to the Winchester College archives to look at Lionel Johnson material, because this is where he was at school. I was with Ruth Derham, who was looking at Frank Russell stuff. She's writing a biography about him, and we were taken by the archivist to a sort of obscure room at the end of our visit. Only had a couple of minutes left, and she just put these books on the table, which were different copies of Lionel Johnson's work, nothing that seemed to be very interesting. And as soon as I saw them, I was thinking, well, that's not the binding that I know. This is very odd. There was only one edition. And you wouldn't know from looking at them that there's anything unusual, because they've been taken apart and rebound with a completely new binding. And Lionel Johnson dedicated all of his poems to somebody, to one of his friends. And these copies have been rebound with letters written from these people to Lionel Johnson. So where Adrian Earle has sort of wiped out so much to do with Lionel Johnson, given the impression that he wasn't really that closely involved. And people have said that these dedications were probably more wishful thinking,
so
more
a bit of
networking.
Name job, kind of an embarrassing name
or a
job
way part of trying to put himself in a community that he wasn't necessarily part of. But these books seem to suggest that that's just not the case. These are very personal letters. A lot of them are very affectionate. Some of them are more to do with sort of literary networking, asking for reviews, asking for comments on their work, but showing him sort of really involved.
Well, actually, he sort of comes across as a bit of a kingmaker. People are sort of writing to him, asking him if he can hook him up with such and such a review.
Absolutely.
Or whatever.
And these are big names.
Yes, yeah, definitely.
So it's Yeats, it's Hardy.
It's Yeats, there's one from Hardy. The Hardy one is thanking Johnson for his book on Hardy, The Art of Thomas Hardy, which was the first book to ever be written about Hardy. And he's very appreciative, yeah.
And the binding of these books, does it look like a DIY job? Does it look like he did it himself?
So I've consulted Tim Wiltshire, who at the Winchester Bindery, which is right next to the college, and he reckons it's a sort of mid between the wars, probably not London-based, quite provincial, possibly a personal job if it's somebody who had some experience.
But that would be after Johnson died.
Absolutely, after Johnson died, yeah. So there's a chance that he had some input. I mean, he chose the names that this was built around, for one. He might have interleaved letters or chosen to keep those letters.
For publication, do you think?
Possibly,
publication?
Or just as a sort of memorialisation or a way of kind of shaping some kind of image of what his time was like. But it's possible that he wasn't involved at all. It may well have just been somebody who had his letters, which
did Adrian Earle
do
it
a lot.
He might have had the letters.
So he never had these letters, because I think if he did have them, then they would have disappeared along with everything else.
Yeah,
they both went to Winchester. What if it was an act of attrition?
What?
Adrian Earle, having realised that he'd sort of stolen all sorts of private belongings.
Yeah.
of a fellow Winchester College student.
It's a bit later, though. So it's between the wars. This is a bit before Adrian Earle's time, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's just before the letters all go back to Isabella Johnson, who was the first person that Adrian Earle steals everything from.
Who was the sister.
Which is Lionel Johnson's sister.
It's a great detective story. Let's talk some more about the letters. Catherine Tynan, you mentioned, is a rather beautiful letter.
Yeah, about the death of her baby son.
Yeah, why were they in touch with one another?
So partly because it's the sort of Irish Catholic network that I think became much more important to Johnson towards the end of the 1890s, as that sort of Rhymers Club group starts to break up. Things like the Wild Trials had happened, certain people were hanging around with different people, spending a lot of time in Dieppe. It wasn't sort of Johnson's scene anymore, it seems. So he started spending more time with his Irish friends, more time in Ireland as well.
And so she says to him, "No one, unless they have had our experience, could realise how a baby of 6 weeks old could leave such a world in ruins." Mm. And then she has another baby later on.
Yeah, quite quickly.
That
Johnson was very affectionate with. She remembers in the memoirs that he used to sort of come cooing into the room to try and hold the baby.
So he's obviously a nice guy. Do you get the impression from reading these things he was not a nice person?
No, personally, I would say so. I think Catherine Tynan particularly, that she focuses on these more personal, more affectionate aspects of his life. She talks a lot about his affection for her dog, poor Dean, who she said that they used to come home from a walk and just find Johnson in the living room with poor Dean in his arms.
A poodle terrier cross.
Yes.
Hypoallergenic, no
Very
doubt.
Very interesting dog.
So you now like Lionel Johnson.
I'm converted.
Yeah. He hated Oscar Wilde.
Is
hate too strong?
Yeah, well, there's been a lot of conjecture about that. The person who this quote from is from, Alfred Ferrand, obviously thought that was the case.
What did he say?
So he said, "I know you hate Wilde."
Yeah.
Which is the strongest expression of hate. There's a tradition that the poem entitled Destroyer of the Soul is written about Oscar Wilde. So Lionel Johnson introduced Alfred Douglas to Oscar Wilde in 1891. And it's said that this poem, which starts, "I hate you with a necessary hate," and is about the corruption of a friend's soul, is about that relationship and what Oscar
So they blame Oscar Wilde for what happened to Bosie.
This is
the corruption
idea
of Bosie.
Yeah. So there's no, Johnson never said that poem was about Wilde never published anything that said so. But he dedicated it to Dash. And in these books that I've found, somebody's filled in OW
really?
In that dash. So they're obviously convinced that...
Would they have known each other, Johnson and Wilde?
Yeah, they would have definitely come across each other. I don't know how well they knew each other, but they enough for him to introduce his Oxford friend, Alfred Douglas, to him.
And presumably we just don't know enough to be able to tell whether Lionel Johnson was in fact in love with Bosie and it was this awkward.
Oh. It would be very difficult to say whether that was the case or not. Certainly some people have conjectured that would be the case, or that this hatred for Wilde was a kind of repressed homosexuality in itself. Mm. I think there's a problem when you start identifying any expressions of hatred or denials as being
Their
in
opposite.
Themselves the opposite. Yeah.
What do we know about Lionel Johnson's romantic life? Anything?
Very little. He talked a lot against homosexuality, just occasionally. There are certain phrases, but yeah, how to interpret that. There are some letters that have veiled references to a possible relationship with a woman at the Alhambra, which was a music hall that was well known for prostitution when he was at university. That's the only evidence of any kind of sexual relationship.
There's a novel to be written about Lionel Johnson, is it?
Is not, definitely think, is, yeah.
And the biography. Are you going to try and write a biography? Is that
if somebody would publish it.
Do you think people wouldn't? How big a figure is he? I mean, this is a fascinating...
Well, it's a difficult thing, isn't it? How big a figure is he is now up for discussion now that you've discovered these books, because all of a sudden a man who seemed isolated, peripheral, marginal, is now very much at the centre of this
Absolutely.
Buzzing literary world.
And this is what these books do. They put him at the centre of interlocking networks. So we've got the Rhymers Club network, the sort of Arthur Symons, Yeats, Richard Le Gallienne are all represented in these letters. But also sort of other networks that might be slightly less expected. There's a sort of Christian socialist network going on there. There's an Irish network. An Irish nationalist network as well, yeah.
Which Oscar Wilde was kind of tangentially connected to in various points.
I don't know which
as well. And also, if he introduced Bosie to Oscar Wilde,
What did he expect?
Yeah, indeed. But that makes him. I mean, that makes him pretty central, doesn't it? I think
absolutely.
But maybe it's a novel. Maybe a novel would do it better than a.
Well, I mean, there's so little concrete information that your imagination can.
This is true. Yeah, and this is what the sort of biographical efforts so far have been largely having to fill in these gaps. And they've been able to do it in the way that they want to a lot of the time. So this starts with Yeats and onwards of using Johnson to sort of symbolise something. Yeah. So for Yeats, he was the symbol of the tragic generation, the sort of torn personality of the 1890s. And, you know, he's not the only one to have made that argument.
I mean, you could write a novel which has Alfred Earl in it as well.
Stig, are you going to write this novel?
No, I'm not going to write this novel. But I'm just saying you could have a sort of 50s aspect with Alfred Earl. I mean, I love the fact he's stealing the bedding, and I also like demanding with menaces, which is
I love that phrase.
Yeah, you don't get that anymore. But no. it's a legal phrase, isn't it?
It's
sort of blackmail.
Blackmail,
isn't it?
Essentially. Yeah.
And you could sort of imagine Alan Hollinghurst writing a kind of a two-stranded novel, two lives interweaving.
Well, there's three of us in this room. I'm not going to. Does anyone want
couldn't possibly.
Just finally then, what do you think the person, whoever it was, collecting that material together, what were they trying to do? Do you have any sense of that?
I mean, I think anybody who had his papers, so there's only really two people who had hold of those papers before Adrian Earle would have had access to them. Both of them, so this Arthur Galton, who was a good friend of his, and Frederick Manning, who was a poet and novelist who lived with Galton. Both of them tried to write biographies. And I'm told that this is quite a common thing to do when you're failing to write a biography, is to create some kind of item or something, some kind of stage, so that you have something that is an achievement. But I think it's interesting that they kept it at that rather than a written biography. There's some kind of deliberate collaboration, idea that this is a biography that's written partly by Johnson and partly by whoever owned the letters and partly by time and partly by the feelings that are aroused by the reader as they're going through these things. A lot of the point seems to be about affection and friendship and the everyday.
Yeah.
I think if anyone,
I'm sure some publishers do listen to this podcast. I think, Sarah, you should be commissioned either to write a novel, or if you don't want to do that, write
stick with the biography.
Do you know, this is a biography that you could see. I mean, it's because it's a silhouette
biography.
There was
a biography a few years ago, wasn't there?
There was. It was a 2012 one. But it doesn't use some of the newer material that's come to light since.
And it's kind of a biography of the age, really. People love the 1890s, don't they?
They do. This is true, yeah.
That's the challenge is for someone listening to this to commission you, Sarah Green, to write a fictional or otherwise description of these events. Sarah Green, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
American justice is a mirage, asserts Clive Stafford Smith this week. He's reviewing Preet Bharara's Doing Justice, a prosecutor's thoughts on crime, punishment and the rule of law from the perspective of someone who is inclined to seek to understand the behaviour of those we deem criminals rather than to tell stories of their punishment. As Sister Helen Prejean taught me and many others, that we are all more than our worst 15 minutes. This is very much the Counsel for Defence's case for prosecution against the Counsel for Prosecution. Clive makes his polemical case about a world of ridiculous success rates, inequality of arms, and questionable prosecutorial practices. He is aghast at the sheer imbalance of it all and brings his own experiences of the failing system, like the time a dog called Junkyard was indicted as a getaway driver in order to help prosecute a case against an outlaw biker. He also considers the most catastrophic interrogation of the century, in which a prisoner was tortured to corroborate the claim of the existence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, leading not only to a false conviction, but contributing to a war that resulted in roughly a million innocent deaths to date, and chaos across the Middle East. Clive, one of the great figures in the world fighting for justice, is always a man to unfold a tale to harrow up your soul, and he is kindly coming to us today from Islamabad to do so. Clive, hello.
Hello.
Let's start with the book, Doing Justice. I think I know the answer to this, but how did it make you feel as you were reading it?
Well, it sort of depresses me in the sense that, and I'm certainly not advertising a book I wrote, which was called Injustice or The Injustice System. But it does strike me that very often in what we call the justice system, we have all the wrong people in the wrong jobs. And, you know, for all what Preet writes in his book, I think it does ultimately reflect that he's a prosecutor who thinks everyone's guilty and thinks that one of the mirages is this notion of the presumption of innocence, because he says, you know, why would I prosecute someone who wasn't guilty? And nowhere in the book does he begin to suggest that perhaps he might have made a mistake or two along the way. And I'm here to tell you that I make mistakes every day. So it sort of reconfirmed my notion that the people who are prosecuting my clients are just never going to admit they make mistakes, and that makes it very dangerous.
And crucially, prosecutors are allowed to handpick the cases, aren't they? So they'll pick the case because they'll think this guy's guilty, and then they'll just go and go and go to prove that.
But that's very true. But they also have unbelievable power, and no one really gets this. But I guess I'd ask you this. If I said to one of you that you're going to either get life in prison or I might even execute you if you don't tell me that the other person there with you in the room is guilty of a crime. But if you are just willing to tell me that other person confessed to you that he or she had done a crime, then I'll let you walk free and I might even give you a payout and put you in the witness protection program, give you a new life and all of that. You know, it takes an amazingly strong person to resist that. At the same time, if I, as a defense lawyer, were to do that, or if I were even to offer a Mars bar to someone to change their story, I'd go to prison for perverting the course of justice. So the sort of imbalance between prosecutors and defense is unbelievable. And you don't get any sense of that from Preet's book. And I'm afraid I don't think you get much of a sense of that generally either in the whole discussion of justice.
I can confirm that Thier is indeed guilty of a crime and did confess to me. You've cracked me already.
You'd do that for the Mars bar, wouldn't you? I mean, you wouldn't even wait for the forgiveness of life in prison.
Ready to roll over, Clive. It's untrue. The statistic that kind of Thier's alluding to there, and you quote in the piece, is that of 70-odd thousand cases that go to disposition in 2016, more than 99% resulted in conviction. When I read that in the proof, I actually asked Toby Lichter to check that fact because it seemed so absurd to me. It didn't seem likely. Is there an argument, though, that this means they're choosing their cases wisely? They're picking cases where they're not running cases where they're trying to railroad people because they're only picking good ones?
Well, the truth is they're not trying to railroad people ever. I don't think you'll find a prosecutor who says, let me find an innocent person and railroad that person. So I don't believe that for one second. What they are doing, though, is they're believing all of these people guilty. And I guess what you have to ask yourself is this. If they have a 99.62% conviction rate, is there anything else in human labors anywhere that has that sort of rate? And do you honestly believe they're that good? And I can tell you they're not, because I personally have counseled people to plead guilty when I thought they were totally innocent, because they were being threatened with the death penalty on the one side, and on the other side, I could work them out a deal where they only had to spend a limited amount of time in prison. And it just was mad to roll the dice, particularly, for example, in a capital case where to get on the jury in America in a death penalty case, you have to swear up and down that you would impose a death sentence. So the deck is pretty stacked in the first place. And I think I would be mad not to advise my client to take a sweetheart deal if offered, just to avoid the risk of dying for something that he or she didn't do.
You mentioned quite a lot of cases in this piece, all of them eye-opening. Should we talk briefly about Brandon Mayfield, who was accused of the Madrid train bombing? What does his case illustrate, do you think?
Well, I think that's very interesting. Brandon Mayfield was a lawyer on the West Coast in the US, who was originally charged with the Madrid train bombing. It was back 15 years ago, and it was a terrorist bombing. And the FBI said that his fingerprint was found on the train and therefore had to show that he was involved in the bombing. And it all turns out to be total nonsense. But the most important thing from where I sit is that this is one of the few cases where Preet admits that the prosecution might make a mistake. Now, he doesn't admit it in any case that his office did, and indeed, the one case where the court said that his office made a mistake, he insists that that's not true. But in this case, he's talking about one of his fellow prosecutors, and his recitation of the facts just illustrates all the problems. You know, he goes through saying, oh my goodness, well, they had reason to think that this guy really was the person who was involved in this terrorist act because, I mean, he had married a Muslim immigrant from Egypt. He himself, underlined, had converted to Islam. Not only that, but he frequented a particular mosque in Beaverton, Oregon, that had received attention from local authorities. So these are the facts, the confirmatory bias that made the prosecutors and the FBI think this guy was guilty. What Preet doesn't mention, most tellingly, of course, is that this poor chap Mayfield, apart from being a U.S. veteran and being, terribly patriotic about the U.S., had not left the country for more than 10 years. And it was easy to prove that he couldn't possibly have been in Spain. And that tells you two things. One is that the FBI, when they were looking at him, were incredibly biased and only looking at the facts that tended to make him look guilty. But second, that Preet himself, when he's telling a story about a catastrophic failure of the system, which really ruined this poor lawyer's life that he was tarred as a terrorist, that he can't bring himself to admit that it was total nonsense and it would have taken very, very little investigation to determine that it was total nonsense.
How did it play out in court, just out of curiosity? Presumably, Brandon Mayfield's lawyers immediately seized upon the detail of him having this, you know, he hadn't left the country, and did that not just sort of stop it there?
No, it's better than that, actually. The Spanish said, this is rubbish. This is not a match of a fingerprint. And the FBI carried on insisting that they thought it was. But then all this other stuff came out. And he was exonerated. But then, of course, he sued.
Yeah.
Because they'd ruined his life. And, you know, in the end, they reached a settlement because they had no alternative. But one of the things that's awfully difficult to get people to do is to say those really, really simple words, I'm sorry. Yeah. And I have to say, I've only ever had one prosecutor ever say that, a really decent guy in Louisiana who had put a guy on death row who was innocent, who said sorry and said it very publicly. But the vast majority, unfortunately, and let's face it, on a human level, it's actually quite hard sometimes for all of us to say the words, I'm sorry. But it's something that the government suffers from intensely, is saying, you know, we just ruined your life, Brandon Mayfield. We're sorry. You know, we sued on behalf of Reprieve, the charity that I founded in London. We sued on behalf of a Libyan who the British had rendered all around the world, Mr. Belhaj, and rendered him with his pregnant wife to Libya, where he got tortured by Gaddafi and all the rest of it. And he was a very principled man, and he didn't want to make lots of money off it. He just wanted the British government to say those simple words, "I'm sorry." And they spent hundreds of thousands of pounds resisting it. Finally, they lost, and they had to do it, and they made an apology in Parliament. But why not just say, "I'm sorry, we just messed up"? And I think that whole reticence to admit a mistake is a huge part of the problem with the judicial process.
You also talk about confirmation bias, and what you seem to get here is that once someone has determined that this person is guilty, there is a whole set of scaffolding that's erected in order to prove the point. And in the case you make in the article is that's often disproportionate, unfair. You can use snitches, you can terrorise witnesses, you can sweeten witnesses. What sort of practices are you talking about? The ability to get someone to say something.
Well, let me say first, my old friend John Ronson, who you know, the author, has written a book on confirmation bias, and he once said to me, "I'd never heard of confirmation bias, but now I've written a book about it, I see it everywhere."
Yes, well done.
Kind of makes the point, doesn't it? Again, the big danger here is not that people are going around trying to force folk to say the wrong thing. It's that they honestly believe it. So a law enforcement agent who comes in thinking that a particular person is guilty is going to be leaning on other people to say what the law enforcement agent wants them to say, because he or she thinks that that's going to prove a guilty person to be guilty. And one thing that Preet says is, we have scum or the devil as our witnesses, but that's okay because the person on trial is the devil or scum. Well, that's kind of presumption of guilt, isn't it? And yet it results in them coercing or threatening many other people to say what's going to convict that individual. Not because they think they're going to convict an innocent person, but because they're certain that person's guilty. But the moment you approach a case that way, you make it inevitable that you're going to convict an innocent person.
It goes further sort of before the event, doesn't it, as well? Because entrapment is something that is supposedly okay.
It's true. I mean, again, I always think about this if it was me doing it. If I came to you and started talking about someone you really don't like, a bit like, I don't know if you remember that story about the guy who I think is now our prime minister.
I knew where you were going.
allegedly. That's not the sort of thing I go around doing, I will say. And even if I had the power, I wouldn't do that. But actually, when you do have that power and you go to someone like whatever the guy's name was, Guppy or whatever his name is, and say, "Look, we think we should go beat this other fellow up." The government can do that. And you and I might not actually be inclined to go beat someone up, but when someone comes along and says, "Let's do it and I'll pay you £100,000 or whatever I'm going to pay you," you make it exponentially more likely that some person who didn't have the wherewithal or even actually ultimately want to go commit a crime is going to go out and do it. And the government does that all the time. And I just said the government does that. I tell you, I don't know. I'm a bit jet-lagged out here in Islamabad, I will say. But the government does that, and they sort of create crimes that would never have existed. And in one of the cases that involved Preet, the judge, had this wonderful line where she said that, this guy was never capable of doing it. And it wasn't until the government came and told him how to do it and encouraged him how to do it that he actually committed or looked like he might commit a criminal offence.
Yeah, Clive, I could talk to you for a lot longer. We're going to have to leave it. But there's a line you say in the piece where you say, "Perhaps there should be a rule that nobody should have the power to send a fellow citizen to prison without a deep understanding of what that punishment entails." If I had the power to make you the chief prosecutor in the United States of America, would you send people to prison?
I mean, I've spent a lot of time in prison. I have a pretty good sense of what a prison's like. I've spent a lot of time in some of those cells in Guantanamo Bay. I think I have a pretty good idea of what it means to say to someone, your human detritus and you're going to spend the rest of your life in a little cell in some awful prison. And, you know, that's a very sobering experience, and it would make me very, very careful if I was in the position that I don't think you're going to give me as chief prosecutor in America.
No.
It would make me very, very reticent before I'd do it. But don't get me wrong. I think, you know, Preet is trying to be a very decent guy, and he's obviously a nice person. I just think that we need to be way, way more careful when it comes to sending our fellow citizens to prison.
Is he looking for office, do you think? Is this a manifesto for office?
I don't know. I think he just published something in the Baltimore newspaper that was hypercritical of Donald Trump. So he's not going to get any sort of office in the next year or two, or maybe not the next 5 years. But who knows later on down the line. And you know, I'm not saying that he's a bad dude, of course. I don't think that at all. And I think he could do certain jobs very well. I just think we need to take the program of being a prosecutor a lot more carefully than he does in his book.
Very good. Clive Zaffer-Smith, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
In 2015, writing in the TLS, David Hurd pointed out that the British public was largely unaware that refugees and asylum seekers were being indefinitely detained in their name in so-called immigration removal centres run, for the most part, by private security companies. The UK, Hurd explained, was the only Western European country in which there was no maximum time limit on immigration detention, so a person could be held without charge for months or even years in prison-like conditions awaiting deportation. In France, by contrast, the limit was 45 days. In any 1 year, around 30,000 people in the UK were held in this way. This was the backdrop against which that same year, Refugee Tales, billed as a walk in solidarity with refugees, asylum seekers and detainees, set out to walk from Dover to Crawley via Canterbury, covering 80 miles in 9 days. Along the way, via collaborations between ex-detainees and established writer-performers, stories were shared with the walking, listening public of life in detention centres or, for those lucky enough to be released, of an existence in limbo with the threat of re-detention ever present. Years later, we are, David Hurd writes this week, more aware of the situation. Indeed, on the particular question of indefinite detention, there is no doubt that political progress has been made. The media, too, is more awake to the injustice. And yet, still, the walks continue. David joins us in the studio now to tell us why. Hello, David.
Hi.
You're not long back from a walk from Brighton to Hastings.
Yes.
How did that one go? Can you give us a sense of how it works?
So this year's walk was bigger and more international, and I think in certain ways more intense than ever. We were walking, so there's about 80 people walk the whole distance, which is 5 days, so as you said, from Brighton to Hastings. But we're joined every day by people who are doing like a day or a couple of days. So at any one time, there might be 200 people walking. Previously, with the exception of the walk from Canterbury, from Dover to Crawley, we've walked into London. We've walked each year from a different direction. We've walked into central London and we've walked into Westminster, and we've sort of symbolically banged on the door of the Houses of Parliament to remind people that we are still detaining people indefinitely in the UK. But this year we changed direction, walking from Brighton to Hastings. In effect, we were walking the border. And we just wanted to be very visible in our presence at the border, partly to remind everybody that it's border policy that produces detention, but partly so that we, as we always try to do, we could rethink that landscape as we walk through it. Each year, we have a series of talks running through the lunchtimes. This year, we had a series of talks entitled Reimagining the Border, where a group of people from different backgrounds and different disciplines just showed us different ways that we might think about the border. So
era of Brexit, presumably borders is particularly
well, and of Trump as well. I mean, Mexico.
I mean, so in the 5 years that we have walked, what we've walked into is a history in which the border and detention at the border has become more and more pronounced. We wish we hadn't had to walk 5 years. We would wish that this wasn't the case. But the fact that the walk was more international, which is to say that there were people joining us from several different countries, is an indicator of the fact that detention is really with us now. We are too many regimes. One regime is too many, but too many regimes are detaining as a matter of default. And there's an understanding that the question has to be addressed both where it's occurring nationally and locally, but in some sense internationally, because plainly detention at the border one way or another is an international issue.
Obviously, there's a long history of walking as protest, but why did walking and specifically telling tales seem like the right form of protest in this context?
The importance of the tales is straightforwardly that at the point at which the project started, out of the work of the Gatwick Detainees Welfare Group, as you were saying right at the beginning, it was very little known that in this country we detain people indefinitely in this fashion. So just as it was very little known, so also the stories of people who experienced detention were almost never heard. There was very little recognition that this was taking place. And it was a matter of kind of great offence that a person could come into this country, live some time in this country, leave this country, and there be in effect no official trace of their having been there. So it became very important to get the story out, partly just to raise awareness, and then through the raising awareness, just to go to the people, the politicians who are making policy around this, to remind them that these stories are the consequences of the policy of detention. I mean, there's all kinds of ways of contemplating that question. I mean, one is that it's actually germane to the hostile environment that the story of the person who has sought asylum here is excluded in all kinds of ways and is thwarted and is disrupted in all kinds of official settings. And not listened to.
Well, I mean, record is made in the hearings, for example.
Well, I mean, it's really a shocking thing, isn't it? But for instance, the bail hearing, the point at which a person might be released from detention, is not a court of record. It's not so hard to record things these days. So this is a kind of shocking thing. There's a written determination, so there is some account given, but the voice of the appellant in that circumstance, the person who sought asylum, does not enter the record. There was a wonderful project which began many years ago called the Bail Observation Project, which would just simply send people in to write everything down, because you know these records need to be kept, and so there's a very active silencing of the voice and therefore the story of the person who has sought asylum and has experienced detention. And I think what the project is partly observing is that therefore there must be a power in that. You only want to silence to the degree that people are being silenced if somewhere or other you have an anxiety that if the story is really told, people might think otherwise.
What do people think? Because that seems to be, you know, we're living in increasingly febrile times where border issues are contentious and people have strong opinions in all sorts of directions.
Yeah.
Are people willing to listen to the stories? You've done this 5 years. Has there been a hostile environment within the public to listening to these stories, as well as a hostile environment created by the government?
So the answer to that is no. We worried right at the beginning, and we still worry that at any point we might encounter hostility. We especially worried at the beginning. We were walking just after the 2015 election. We were walking through Kent and Surrey and Sussex, not obvious territory that might be sympathetic to this project.
UKIP territory, really.
Yeah, I mean, certainly Kent at that time was almost, yeah, I mean, certainly it almost went UKIP at that point, parts of Kent. So this was potentially hostile territory. Now, in fact, what we have encountered wherever we have gone is great shows of hospitality. In fact, what we say in response to this question is we get offered more cake than we can possibly eat as we walk through these spaces. Now, this is part. This will, you know, I guess one reason for that is that people who come to hear the public performances are to some degree self-selecting. This is not to say that they already know about the situation, because many people leave those readings having discovered this fact of indefinite detention. But, you know, they're going along there in the first place. But really what we sense is that there is a desire, not amongst everybody, but amongst a large number of people, to have a different narrative told around the question of the border and around the question of migration and around the question of asylum. There's actually a yearning for it, and I think that's one of the reasons that the project has gained the degree of momentum that it has.
The Home Office has pointed to a reduction in recent years of the number of detainees. Why should we be sceptical or dissatisfied with that claim?
We shouldn't be, in a sense, in that a lowering of the number means that the number is going in a good direction. But I do want to contextualise this just a little bit. So that the power to detain was granted to the Secretary of State in immigration legislation from 1971. And it's very interesting to notice the graph which shows how much that power has been used. So in 1973, 95 people were detained indefinitely in this country. And then in 1988, there were 2,166 people detained indefinitely. And then in 2015, when we started walking, over 29,000 people were being detained indefinitely in this country. Now, that figure has come down. So in the year ending 2018, 24,748 people were detained indefinitely. So a reduction is a good thing. But what we are observing is that the power itself, the law that allows this, is wrong, and that when introduced, it was arguably it wasn't intended to be used to this degree, but this is the degree to which it has been used, and therefore it's absolutely imperative that the law is changed so that while we are currently seeing something of a reduction, not much of a reduction, but something of a reduction, that we don't at some point in the near future or whenever see a similar escalation.
Likewise, if the detention comes to an end, what are they being released to? Because that's the other side of things.
That's the hostile environment. And, you know, the piece tries to describe at some length what that hostile environment means. But, of course, if you really want to understand what the hostile environment means, then you probably ought to look at the tales themselves, which are told both in that collaborative way that you're describing, but increasingly in first-person narratives, where people just record what it's like to live in what you're calling a shadow world, a kind of, you know, this limbo that people talk about. Indefinite detention is core to the hostile environment. A person who has sought asylum in this country has to report their presence to the Home Office on a regular basis, a weekly or a fortnightly basis. They have to report in at a reporting centre, and it's typically at that moment of reporting that they might be detained or re-detained. In other words, it's the fact of the possibility of indefinite detention haunts a person for as long as they are in this circumstance. Hannah Arendt would call that a kind of terror. Okay, there is a terror being inflicted on those people. And what we need to remember here is that the numbers of people experiencing that are the kind of numbers that we're talking tens of thousands of people who are experiencing that on a daily basis.
We'll have to leave it, but just for people listening now, what should they do? Should they go and read these stories? Should they give money? What action would you like people to take?
Okay, so there's perhaps three things that a person might do. It would be great if people were to read the tales. There are three volumes of Refugee Tales now. And if, having read the tales, they're moved to act further, they should visit the Refugee Tales website, refugeetales.org. And having visited that, what they really ought to do, if they are as shocked as many people are that we do this in this country, they should contact their MP and they should urge a very immediate change. And if I could just add one thing, the good news here is that because of the work of many organisations, there is an amendment hovering in Parliament right now amidst all the confusion of Brexit, which would effect an end to indefinite detention, which has 88 signatories. Those signatories come at the moment from across all parties, not mostly from the government, but there are government MPs there. This is a moment where things could change. It could stall, but things could change. If people were to write to their MPs to remind them that this has to happen, that would be great.
Well, I hope people do that. David Hurd, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to David, to Sarah Green and to Clive Stafford-Smith. Get hold of this week's TLS for lots of poetry, plus Country Houses, Smog, Feminism and much more. Next week, no Thea, I believe. I say without...
Sorry, I will be walking, in fact.
Will you?
Yeah.
Wait, where are you going?
Cornwall.
Oh, how lovely.
To finish something I started 2 years ago.
A walk?
Yeah.
Not a jigsaw puzzle.
Ha ha ha.
The walk.
All right,
you can report back about that. We're going to be turning our minds in Thea's absence to the avant-garde. Best black polo necks on. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.